I started my inner exploration at the ripe old age of 23 when I, sort of by accident, started doing asana practice with a yoga teacher in this town I lived in the south. And in those days, hardly anyone did the postures, the asana practice. And through her, became acquainted with the world of Raja Yoga, and which is the royal road, which involves meditation and the whole process of the forest tradition there in India. And in doing this, it turned out that I had some natural inclination towards this this exploration as being a life purpose. But I was also young and wanting to establish myself in the world and test myself against the world. And there ensued a very long process of my being at odds with myself in terms of, was I about worldly success or was I about finding my way in this spiritual life? And the first time it came to a head was at the age of 30. I had developed quite an intensive practice by then, and very daily in its occurrence, so that an hour and a half, 2 hours a day would be in yoga and meditation, and then a lot of seeing my world from the point of view of what was the yoga, what was the stretch in that world. And one of the great frustrations that I had is that I could go to this ashram that I would go to study with this one particular teacher. And when I was in that ashram, I would find myself being in relation to the experience of life, this inner and outer, in a way that was balanced, in a way that was peaceful, in a way that felt meaningful to me, that I very much cherished. But then I would get on an airplane, come back to my regular life, and I would watch this inner sense of well-being just slowly fade away. And the more I did this, rather than those days extending longer and longer, the shorter they would extend. So that the final insult of it was, I got on the plane and I was this very peaceful, loving person, got off the airplane, then this regular tormented mind of dealing with wants and desires. And so it gradually became clear to me that there was, the way I was doing this was not working. And yet I was very grateful to have a practice. And around 30, I said to myself, okay, just leave the world. Just give all this up. I was an entrepreneur and I had a magazine company and I was the editor-in-chief of this series of special interest magazines. And I said, well, okay, just give it up. Just leave the world. And I set about doing that. And I then, including selling the company, and I had a letter of intent to sell the company. And then at the last moment, I had what I term a failure of imagination. And what happened was, I said, so now exactly, it became quite real to me that I was actually doing this. And I said, well, now how is this actually going to work? What is my life going to look like day in and day out? So was I going to take up robes? Was I going to study psychology to be part of this inner study? And I could imagine doing all these things in one sense, but I had no role models. I did not have a close relationship at all with this teacher with whom I studied, although he had done me a great favor. I had gone to him a few years into working with him, and he had never sort of invited me into this inner circle that was part of his group, and he had quite a large following. But so one day I went to him and I said, you know, I noticed that everyone else that has studied with you as long as I have has a mantra, and they all do mantra practice. And you've never given me a mantra, so would you be willing to give me a mantra? And he got very stern, and he says, no mantra for you. And I was, you know, taken back. And he said, I want you to just empty your mind and think of nothing. I thought that meant that I wasn't yet ready for a mantra, because I was not a Dharma bum. I was this guy that was a workaholic, you know, who was leading this kind of split life. And so I very dutifully sat down to do what he had told me to do, which was to empty my mind and think of nothing. Lo and behold, this turned out to be something that I could in some way approximate. And this led me to this deeper way of practice, which led to the point of at 30 of my leaving the world as a possibility that this was something that I was so close to doing, because he had thrown the practice back onto myself in a way that was very, very useful for me. Did he do this to shoo me away? Did he do this as insight? Who can know? I certainly don't know. We never became close in that way. And so to this day, and he is now dead, but to this day, I don't know what was in his mind, what he was seeing or not seeing. And I didn't think about it a lot, and I still don't. It was just part of my development. And so when I realized that I didn't have a real vision as to what I was doing, it really struck me that, well, part of this is that I don't feel as though I have a peer group, what in our language, a sangha, that I would be coming part of something that I understand that would welcome me in some way. I didn't feel lined up in that way. And then I was aware of the fact of how very difficult it is to proceed at certain points in the journey without some sort of a relationship to a teacher. Many times, at least in my experience with myself and lots and lots of students, you go along for long periods of time just fine, because you come to a group like this and you hear a teacher, and then maybe you come only occasionally, or you go to an occasional retreat, and you don't really get maybe that much personal contact, but you get it from the general feeling, and it's enough. And I tell people this all the time, that you don't need nearly as much personal attention you can come into this practice thinking you need a lot of personal relationship with the teacher. But for the most part, no. But there are times when it really, really matters. Otherwise, you have a failure of imagination. So, I did not leave the world and instead moved to New York City to take over a magazine. You can see how well-balanced I was at that point. And I did this, and the magazine was Esquire magazine. I became editor-in-chief of Esquire magazine. This was in 79. And I did it because if I was not leaving the world, I had to have more a passion about something to stay in the world. Because being an editor of these specialized magazines and making money and all of that just didn't interest me. It couldn't hold me. I had to have something that I was passionate about in the world to stay in the world. So I did. I moved to New York and I started living that life. And almost right away, ran into difficulty with my practice. I had been so loyal and my practice had supported me so well. But it took a lot of time. It was an hour and a half, 2 hours a day of practice. And I started losing the ability to do that practice. First, I wouldn't sit. Then I wouldn't do the pranayama. And then it came to the point that I couldn't even do asana without going to a class. And I was just surprised at myself because I was still dutifully doing my daily life. In the morning, going up in the elevator, I would remind myself that I was going into a series of postures in doing my work, that there would be these stretches, and that I was trying to cause no harm, and that, and I would really have to cultivate this attitude. And yet I was losing the support of the practice underneath. So as you can imagine for yourself, that's pretty dismaying. And it was a combination of factors, which I won't take the time to iterate tonight. But part of it was this sense of not being part of something strong enough. So I didn't have anything to balance this extreme work week that I maintained, which was sort of minimum at 80 hours. So it was pretty extreme. Some of you may remember your days like that. Some of you may still be doing that. Or maybe you never did that. Maybe you were able to avoid that. So then, to my good fortune, a fellow yogi said, you know, I keep hearing about this thing called Vipassana. And how about going up to a retreat with me? So we drove up to the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts, where probably many of you have been at one time or another. And I set my first retreat. And things couldn't have gone more wrong. First of all, I got there late. So there was this little notice that said, this is where your room is. And they were already in silence. So I go downstairs. Now, I've not read anything about Vipassana meditation or any of this. So this is a completely new world to me. I go downstairs to where they've directed me, and it turns out I'm in the old gymnasium. There's no longer a gymnasium there. But in those days, there was still a gymnasium when it had been a Catholic monastery. But there was a sign on the door that said, sorry, but you have to keep your shoes on because the pipes have burst. So there's water on the floor. Sit on your bed to remove your shoes. This was in February in Massachusetts. And being a good yogi, I accepted all of that, only at the end of the retreat to find out that there was, in fact, an empty bed somewhere else. So I and one other poor guy, slept in this gymnasium with, an inch or so of water on the floor. And that was the beginning of the retreat. Then I go to the next morning to the first guided meditation, and the instructor says, do not control your breath. Just let your breath be. Well, I had spent years learning how to control my breath. I had no choice but to control my breath. I had habituated controlling the breath, and in controlling the breath, finding these very subtle states and sometimes quite wonderful altered states of meditation. I just happened to have the proclivity to have those states, so I'd had a lot of that experience. And here this guy is saying, don't control your breath. Well, if you don't control your breath, your mind's going to go all over the place, as you may have noticed from your own practice. And so, yes, indeed, that's what happened. Not one moment of real concentration in that whole retreat. So there I was, sleeping in this freezing cold place, not doing what was my practice. And then on top of that, this particular teacher and I were just not simpatico at all, and that was an ongoing thing. We did not perceive the practice of the world in the same way or anything else, and it was the most discouraging 3 days. And so drive back to New York, go to my apartment, I really just rah-rah-rah on myself. Not so much on the teacher, but on myself. Like, what's wrong? This is just really upset with myself. And for whatever reason, I just suddenly sat down on the floor in my bedroom where I would usually sit for meditation. Bang. Straight into a concentrated state. The mind just still. No thoughts coming, just stillness. Just bang. Sat down and closed my eyes, and there it was. So when I got up from that particular sit, I said, there may be something here. And lo and behold, that was the beginning of my journey into Vipassana and what became my substantial practice, what became my commitment. And what made a huge difference for me in that is in subsequent years, although it took a while, it took a few years to find the people that I was able to line up with, I found a series of teachers that I could believe in, that I could relate to, that would relate to me. And those teachers made a difference in terms of keeping me with this and helping me find my way, so that in fact I was able to do at 40 what I could not do at 30, which was just give it all up and give myself over full time to this practice. It was a dramatic moment to do that. And it was having the confidence and having people that I believed in as part of that. So then fast forwarding to some years later, and I have the good fortune to attend a retreat being taught by the Venerable Ajahn Sumedho. I'm sure some of you have sat with Ajahn Sumedho or come to some of the Daylongs, because I know he comes here quite a bit for family reasons or has at various times. So instantly I realize I'm with a teacher that I really want to be sitting with. I mean, just feel it, and there's this coming home kind of quality that maybe some of you have known. And then second day, third day into this retreat, he suddenly starts talking about the Four Noble Truths. And I've heard by this time, I don't know how many talks on the Four Noble Truths, and it's one more talk, and I'm enjoying him, and so I'm glad that, you know, to be there with him, and it's okay that he's talking about the Four Noble Truths, and, you know, yes, I know that he's heard all this, but that's fine. And then he introduces a teaching that somehow I had completely missed, that I'd never been exposed to in months and months and months of sitting with lots of different teachers, which was the teaching of the Four Noble Truths as 12 insights. A very different approach, understanding of the Four Noble Truths, coming out of the Samyutta Nikaya text of the way that the Four Noble Truths are presented in that particular sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. And wow, you know, for me, there had been numerous insights that I had had that suddenly got connected. It was as though someone was connecting the dots for me. And I, during the course of these days, I felt my understanding growing and my deepening into the understanding, as this term I used during the guided meditation, of the felt sense. The felt sense is another way of referring to this intuitive knowing, this direct experiencing that is the very heart of our practice, that we know directly. We don't conceptually know, not up in the old coconut, but we know in the felt sense, we know in our hearts and belly what's true. It's that level that's the insight. It's not the conceptual level that's referred to as insight practice. But this bypassing the conceptualization of the frontal lobes and this deep knowing. So I became quite involved in this in my own practice, and approaching the Four Noble Truths as a practice, which until he explained all this, I had never heard of the Four Noble Truths as practice. And I immediately started doing those and developed a relationship with Ajahn Sumedho, and it came to be the main thrust of my practice, and in time led me, with his encouragement, to creating Dancing with Life, which is all about the Four Noble Truths as a practice of these 12 insights. It won't be for everyone, and I'm not taking you through these 12 insights tonight, or I'm going to talk a little bit about the First Noble Truth and the insights associated with that, but when I'm back here, I will be going through these 12 insights in more detail. And so as I say, for some of you, this won't be your cup of tea, but for some of you, some pieces of this approach may be useful, it may be helpful. And for a few of you, it may be a way that you want to move in such that this becomes part of what every set of practices or orientations or attitudes or commitments that you have in terms of your practice. The basic organization of this as a practice, the Four Noble Truths as a practice, is that the first insight of each truth is an intellectual presentation. So there is suffering. You can think about that. You use the old coconut. Yeah, so what does he mean there as suffering? What was the Buddha talking about? And so like one of the distinctions one might make intellectually is he saying that everything is suffering? That was not what he was saying, at least as I read the text. But so what does it mean to you? And so you listen to people, you read, you talk with people. So it's an intellectual understanding, and you have an intellectual insight. Yeah, I understand this. I understand what this is about intellectually. And then the second insight of each of the four truths is a know it for yourself. Experience it. Do it. Live it. Know it from within. Very interesting, by the way, in relation to the second of the Four Noble Truths, that, in terms of how that actually plays out as practice. Because we don't tend to teach that much, the way it, when you, it's really sort of changes it when you do it as practice. But sticking now with the First Noble Truth, so there is suffering, and this suffering is to be penetrated. So therefore, in your own life, you, with mindfulness and compassion and loving kindness, you open to the experience of suffering. Your suffering, the suffering of those you love, the suffering of the world. You open to it by feeling the ouch of it. Suffering feels like this. The dissatisfaction, the stress, the unreliability, the embarrassment when, you know, you've done something that you're a little uncomfortable with, or anger, the suffering of coming from anger or disappointment or loss or wanting or aversion, that you actually feel the ouch of that in a very specific way. As I was asking you to notice the body in a very specific way in the guided meditation, to really be present for the experience, free of your ideas and concepts about it, free of your judgments about the experience, but feeling the ouch of the suffering. Where is the stickiness? Where is the friction? That is the suffering. Where the Buddha over and over again talked about the eye is burning, the ear is burning, the nose is burning. This friction, this burning, where is that in this particular moment? Just noticing it. Just noticing it. Just being with it. So that you have, at some point, the insight. Ah, I know suffering. This is suffering. This is suffering. And then the third insight of each truth is what I call in a shorthand way, knowing that you know. That is that suffering, it says in the text, suffering has been known. But this what we could refer to as the integration of your insights, so that when you actually know it in your whole being, not as a individual incident, like, oh yeah, this is suffering, but no, suffering, there is suffering. You know it without having to be in the very moment of the suffering. You know it, that this is suffering. That is an insight level, and it changes your experience of the world, that, oh yeah, this is suffering. So, and that there's this knowing of suffering. It becomes part of the context of which all of your decisions are made, of what you see, of how you're relating to desire and all, even before you develop further. So one way of understanding these truths, these insights of the 12 insights of the four truths, is that it's a progression. You develop one, and that gives you the base for the next and next and so on. Another way to understand it is that you're always learning all 12 insights, and as you learn one, it goes back and it supports the other. And so for instance, once you gain a deeper insight into the second insight of the second noble truth, then when you go back and reflect on all the insights of the first noble truth, it deepens. So it's this kind of supporting and deepening. And then the classic way that the Four Noble Truths have been taught, at least in my presence, is that in the moment of cessation, all 12 insights are realized in their fullness at once. So there's this completion of it all. There's this full realization. The lotus flower is completely open. So three different ways that you can think about these Four Noble Truths, the 12 insights. So tonight, what I mostly want to do is to talk about why the Four Noble Truths as a practice makes sense, and to do that particularly in relation to this noble truth of suffering, the noble truth of suffering. What I have found is that there is a lived system in terms of the Four Noble Truths when we treat them as practice. This is what Ajahn Sumedho says in the introduction to my book. He was kind enough to write a preface. I went to live in the remote... This is midway in his text. I went to live in the remote forest monastery of the great Thai teacher, the Venerable Ajahn Chah, where I became his devoted student and stayed for the next 10 years. Ajahn Chah's approach to meditation practice was very practical. The traditional monastic form and discipline were taught and practiced in daily life. The Dharma teachings were always about the Four Noble Truths. It is a complete description and an accurate roadmap to freeing oneself from the delusions that cause human suffering. I have observed how rarely the practical use and application of this essential teaching of the Buddha are taught and practiced in Theravadan countries. Even the Vipassana movement in the West seems to only pay lip service to it, when in fact the Four Noble Truths are a lifetime's reflection. I find it quite mind-boggling that in the Buddhist world, this really profound teaching has often been dismissed as primitive Buddhism. And that is often the attitude. We all know the Four Noble Truths. Let's get to the serious teaching, huh? So that's understandable, because we're all wanting to make things more and more complex and look for things to achieve. So that's just part of that happens. And yet, the Four Noble Truths are the one teaching that all three of the great Yamas, the Theravadan, the Mahayana, and the Tibetan, all three of these Yamas say that all the teachings are contained in the Four Noble Truths. So this is the point of total agreement. And yet, we tend to tend to treat them as like, okay, this is some sort of philosophical statement and go on. So one value is that we move from a philosophical statement of these to a lived truth in our lives as lay people. Another advantage of them is that it solves the ontological problem that's there in Buddhism. When the Four Noble Truths are treated as philosophy, there is, this is a little bit heady here, so stick with me for a moment. There is a problem in that the Buddha was not given an ontological explanation of life. He was not doing that. Most of you have probably heard at one time or another the teaching on the handful of leaves. He picked up a handful of leaves as he was walking to the forest with his monks. And he said, "Monks, are there more leaves in my hand or in all the trees of the forest?" Being very observant, they said, "Oh, there's more leaves on all the trees in the forest." And he says, "Just so. What I teach is like this handful of leaves. What I know is like all the leaves in the forest." So he did not go into ontological explanations. He said, "I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering." So he was teaching us a way out of our dilemma. And when we try to place Buddhism in an ontological way, we get into a kind of intellectual quagmire or a little repeating kind of thing, like you're caught in a raft in the river and you're going around and around one of those little swirls. It's also that the Four Noble Truths as a practice, as a lived experience, present a way out of the existential dilemma of life. The existential dilemma of life we've all encountered long before we were able to conceptualize much of anything. And it's essentially that we die and that everything we care about dies. Everything we care about goes away. Each of you, when you were a child, had your first experiences with this, when you realized, oh no, people die. I die. And those of you who are parents have been through that with your children, the kinds of questions they ask and how they start working this out. This is an existential dilemma. From Nietzsche to Sartre to whomever, this has been spoken about in various ways. It is a priori to any kind of a belief system. It's a practical problem. It changes what it means to be alive, that it ends. And we're stuck with that as a problem. And the Four Noble Truths, as Ajahn Sumedho was saying, is a roadmap that actually allows us to live our lives in the context of this existential truth. You know, one of the great phrases that's used in many of the chants is this phrase, A.E. Pasaka, this come see for yourself. Open to the experience for yourself. Because this is such a key part of the Buddha's teaching. He's not asking you to believe. He is saying, these are skillful means to see for yourself. For me, this was tremendously inspiring. And I have seen that we can, in fact, trust ourselves to see for ourselves, if we equip ourselves and have patience and persistence in this process. In this practice, we're making a fundamental decision. We're choosing to relate to suffering in a certain way. Ajahn Chah, the Venerable Ajahn Chah, Sumedho's teacher, said the following. There are two kinds of suffering. The suffering that leads to more suffering. Anybody in here not know that kind of suffering? Anybody in here not pretty much an expert in that kind of suffering? I certainly am. There are two kinds of suffering. The suffering that leads to more suffering and the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. If you're not willing to face the second kind of suffering, you will surely continue to experience the first. So clear and simple. So clear and simple. If you're not willing to face the second kind, you will certainly continue to live the first. So this is our choice. As we move into the Dharma, we are choosing to face our suffering. It's a remarkable thing that each of you do when you do that. Most of the world, and certainly in our culture, chooses the first kind of suffering. To quote T.S. Eliot, we distract ourselves from distraction by distraction. We move away, we fantasize, we want, we find something to want. If we don't want anything, we look through catalogs looking for something to buy. If we don't have anything we want to watch on television, we flip the channels, looking, hoping that maybe something will distract us. And if nothing else, we're distracted by the very movement of our distraction. It's a kind of numbing ourselves, a kind of fantasizing about there being a moment when, well, now I'm going to get it right. But in doing Vipassana, we're showing up for what is. That doesn't mean we're showing up for the bleakness. It means we're showing up for the whole thing. We're there for that moment of sunset. We're there that moment of the baby's laugh and delight. We're there when someone touches our cheek softly. We're awake for it. We're present for it. More present because we're not grabbing to have more of it. We're able to stay with it in the context that there's this kind of a bittersweetness to it because it goes away. So the poignancy of life is available to us. And likewise, in the negative, the difficult of life, we're able to stay more fully present for it and therefore add less of our additional suffering to whatever's already difficult in that moment. So it's quite a heroic and radical and remarkable thing we do to move into this kind of relationship to suffering. It's not what most people do most of the time. So just to give you four examples of this, how many times in your own life in relation to some stressful or unsatisfactory or uncertain or difficult or painful or just plain out suffering moment have you said to yourself, oh, this is some huge defeat for me? Have you felt like a humiliation or an inadequacy? Some sort of turning on yourself as a kind of self-judgment, some sort of feeling as though this was an insult to your ego, to your ability to control. How many times? Just today. Have you had that little moment over something or another? You didn't say something right in a meeting, or you were having this discussion about something with your partner and it didn't go right, and you took it so personal as an ego defeat, making your suffering personal. Or likewise, how many times do you, when you've had some sort of difficulty arise, experience it as a kind of social stigma that you feel judged because, like, oh, well, here I am. I've got this terrible disease. And you're sort of embarrassed, by this terrible disease as though there was, you're a little ashamed of it. So you've got cancer and, like, there was something wrong with you having cancer. Or you think you weigh too much. Or you don't earn as much money as your friends from college. Or you're not able to present in the meetings as well as the colleague that shares your space with you, and you're unhappy with this, or you failed at something, or you've caused some harm, and you've made it personal. You've taken the suffering and made it personal that you're ashamed of it, as though somehow suffering belonged to you rather than suffering being something that arises because of causes and conditions. To all of us, when those causes and conditions are present, suffering arises. This is what the Buddha was teaching. But we forget it, and we make it personal in this way of humiliation, or we make it personal in terms of this kind of shame, culturally, socially, societally. Or how many times have you taken a kind of personalized blame? Oh, well, if there's suffering in my life, I must be doing something wrong. I must be doing something wrong, or this wouldn't be happening. What have I done wrong? And it may not be a specific, but there's this vibe of it. Oh, that I've done something wrong. I can't conceive. I must have done something wrong. I'm alone. I'm not married. I want to be married. I must have done something wrong. And on and on and on. We personalize. We make it as though we are guilty. No, it's causes and conditions. It's causes and conditions. Or that you may have felt that, you know, I didn't deserve this. You know, I didn't deserve to have this parent who was abusive to me. I didn't deserve to have this accident happen to me when I was 5. And so we become victims in relation to suffering. So in each of these different ways, we make it personal. We make it somehow unique in a way that it's not. We fail to be relating to it in a way that we can become free in our relationship to it. So there's this kind of paradox around suffering, because on the one hand, we can't really control it. Suffering happens. And yet, paradoxically, we are responsible for how we respond. Because there's some degree of choice that we have. We have some degree of co-creativity in any given moment of our lives. So easy to forget that. So easy to be swept away into our reactivity of mind rather than to what I term responsive mind. Reactivity of mind is just this Pavlovian kind of condition. Something happens and it's painful and you react. Responsive mind is where you have this awareness of the Dharma and you realize there's choice. Maybe your choice is only in what you say or don't say. Or maybe your choice is only in what you intend, what you wish that you intended. But there's some degree of choice, and that choice changes that moment, and it plants the wholesome karmic seed for future moments. So it's a very different relationship that's possible with suffering. And yet it's difficult to move into this when we are in reactive mind. We are in a way moving from the objectivity of suffering, that is, suffering happens when conditions are such that the causes are there, to what this wonderful Jungian analyst, Helen Luke, I don't know if any of you have ever read any of Helen Luke's writings. She died a few years ago at 96. Very, very wise woman, very wonderful. And she terms that kind of suffering neurotic suffering. And she doesn't mean neurotic like as a term that it's neurotic because it's subjective. It's that we're adding to it. We're adding to it. It's that first kind of suffering rather than the second kind of suffering that Ajahn Chah was talking about. So Ajahn Sumedho, when he's talking about these first three insights around suffering, he refers to it as being willing to stand under the suffering, the way you would stand under a waterfall, that you're willing to stand there and be present for the actual experience of the water coming down on you, as opposed to standing on the bank and going, oh, look at that pretty waterfall. You're standing under in it. You're actually feeling what I term feeling the ouch of the suffering. Helen Luke points out that our word suffering comes from this word fere in Latin, the idea of being willing to bear, the way a wagon will bear a load. The wagon doesn't have any particular extra reactivity to the load. It just carries the load as best it's able. So this to bear the load, to carry the load, to stand under, this is the idea of the First Noble Truth as a practice. Very different than our usual approach where we go, oh yes, the First Noble Truth, there is suffering, and then we want to rush on to the Second Noble Truth. We don't actually, at least in my experience base, most of us don't take the time to explore it as insight in and of itself. And yet from this teaching of the 12 insights, a whole quarter of the insights are contained in knowing suffering. It's that second kind, as Ajahn Chah was saying. Read it again. There are two kinds of suffering, the suffering that leads to more suffering and the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. If you're not willing to face the second kind of suffering, you will surely continue to experience the first. Facing the second kind of suffering is this standing under, this carrying the load. Knowing suffering in its objective experience, suffering is like this. It's difficult for us to do this for a lot of reasons, but when we can do it, we come to an innate dignity in our lives. Some of you had a grandparent or maybe a parent, or you knew someone or know someone now who has had great suffering in their life, and yet they've got this kind of dignity where you actually end up feeling better about yourself in their presence. Some of you had that experience. They have had this second kind of relationship to suffering. They have accepted it in its terms. That doesn't mean that you give up your preferences. Of course you want your child to be healthy. Of course you want to have the kind of life you want to have. But you accept life as it is and know life as it is, while moving as well as possible towards your goals. And so there's this kind of innate dignity that comes from that. There's also a different kind of passion available for life. At least this is what I'm suggesting to you to go see for yourself. Because when you don't have to turn, not even a little bit, your passion is unguarded in a certain way. You're willing to receive whatever experience comes from opening your heart. Therefore, you can open your heart. And it's different. Just for you to explore for yourself. In our Western culture, we have had at times a heroic view of suffering. I sometimes say to students that if we were couching it in these modern terms, it would be one lousy truth and three great truths. Or it would be some sort of the great plague of suffering and three easy steps to rid yourself of it. It's true, isn't it? Why is that? Why is that true? Because in our society, we have this orientation towards the pleasant. We have this hidden message, not so subtly delivered, but hidden nonetheless, that if you have the most pleasant moments, that means you've won. And we have this idea that you're supposed to be able to control your life. Winners don't have unpleasant moments. They don't have unpleasant moments. We know that's not true, and yet it's there in the images of happiness that's presented in our media. There's also this idea of instant gratification. And so that, I'm not supposed to suffer now. And then we also live in this from a Buddhist point of view, this delusion that everything's supposed to be ego-defined. I should be able to control my world because my ego, that part of me that organizes the way I use this word of ego, that organizes experience and my facilities to meet experience, is supposed to be able to control this. That the measure of a person is their ego, their ego's performance in terms of avoiding suffering. Not going to go into the teaching tonight, but the opposite of suffering is not this pleasant happiness. That's not the opposite of suffering. That's not at all my understanding of the Buddhist teaching. This is for a later time. But we have not always been this way. First of all, just in the Judeo-Christian tradition, at least in terms of Christian tradition, the idea of Jesus in terms of this his kind of passion. And in the Jewish tradition, Moses is one who does not go to the promised land and yet is fulfilled. So we have it in our basic religions. We have it in terms of the Greek mythology. When Prometheus steals the fire, he full well knows that he will experience suffering for stealing fire to give to human beings. Fire being the knowledge, the understanding that's allowed us to move into our own freedom. At that time, there was this idea that the gods were jealous of human beings, which also has this interesting overlap with the Buddhist teaching that the human birth is more precious than a birth in a heavenly realm. But he stole this fire, and each day he was tied to this rock. Each day this eagle comes, eats out his liver. Every night it grows back. And he endures this. He is willing to meet life as it is for him. And then there is in Shakespeare, the difference of the suffering of the Macbeths, right? There's their suffering, this neurotic suffering, this compulsion, this desire, this each of them feeding off the other in this way to control their world, versus the suffering of Prospero when he was left on this deserted island with his young daughter, and which he, in the course of his life, he is able to live that through and not become bitter, and so find a freedom. So there, in Shakespeare's values, one of the most important minds in the West in terms of shaping all of our minds. And then in Dante's Divine Comedy, in the hell realm, there is this pointless suffering because they refuse to bear the suffering. So they will not own their own mistake. In modern theology, it's referred to as a separation, being separated, not being willing to carry the consequences of their own acts. Whereas in purgatory, when Dante, you know, Virgil's taking him through the hell realm, takes him into purgatory, and here all of these people are carrying their suffering, they're involved in all this toil, and he goes, oh, I'm going to pray for you to get rest. And they say to him, don't pray for us to get rest. Pray for us to have the energy to complete our task. This second kind of suffering, this willingness to meet life as it is and know it so that we are not caught in reactive mind. Our refusal to do that is a hell realm. It's a hell realm. We stay in that first kind of suffering. And so if you think of Odysseus and his great journey, such an imperfect person, huh? So inflated. And being inflated about his ego, what he can do, first of all, he gets his beloved companions killed. And over again finds himself in these kinds of situations of suffering. But gradually, he more and more comes to bear it. He becomes more and more humble, more and more honest, more and more willing to know life as it is, rather than escaping And he finds his way home, finds his way home. I do a whole series of the Dharma in each of these, by the way, and it's quite fun. Since I'm saying this, I'm taking this little bracketed moment here. Anytime you're in the Bay Area, you're welcome to come to my Sunday Sangha in Corte Madera. They are people just like you. You'd feel quite at home there. And we focus on the Dharma in daily life. And then I do daylongs just for the Sangha, which if you've been there once, you're qualified to come to, in which I'll take some subject like this, and we take some Western myth and deconstruct it in depth in terms of Dharma teachings. It's really a lot of fun. So anyway, back to our subject tonight. We have this history of being able to bear our suffering, to be interested in it, to treat it as part of life in a way that we can gain insight. Gain insight for the purpose of all our life. Not just the difficult, but all our lives. Being able to meet everything with this open heart, with this coming to our life from our deep intention. The second of the Eightfold Path, Sammasamkhapa, this wise or right intention. If we aren't willing to face our suffering, then it's almost impossible for us to do that, because our intention is to be present. To be present, to not cause suffering. To not cause suffering, we have to know suffering to know how to bring the end of suffering, to bring loving kindness. If we're going to stay compassionate in the moment, we're going to have to know the suffering. To give you a political example, and I'm not taking sides in this, but to understand, you may be very upset about some of the things that our country has done or is doing. If you go into reactive mind, you condemn people. You may feel hatred. You may have to distract yourself from even thinking about it because it's so upsetting. And yet, if you're seeing that same situation as, oh, this is suffering, you can feel compassion. You can stay present. You're far more likely, if you're being active, to act with wisdom from the second relationship to the suffering of it than the first. Otherwise, you fall into what became a problem with the 60s in many ways, where this idea of killing for peace, which was a real delusion of starting from a really wonderful feeling. When I worked in a prison for 4 years as a volunteer teaching yoga and meditation, and some of the people I worked with were some of the people that were in prison from that time, and to see how much wisdom they had gained, and seeing how much they had seen. Oh no, there's a new, different way to be with suffering. And by the way, they love the Dharma. And there's still one person that I write letters every time, trying to get the parole board to possibly open to letting this person who was the least harmful person one can imagine out, to have her life back. But again, this willingness to open to the truth of life, all of life, all of life. That's the teaching in these first three insights. So when we do this, we are in our own way learning to dance with life. We're learning to dance with life. I termed it dance with life because it is all of life that we are being in relationship to when we approach it through the Four Noble Truths, this practice. We dance with life. And when you're dancing, life's going to dance with you one way or the other. Is anyone in here not old enough to have realized that yet? So then it becomes a question of what kind of dance partner do you want to be? So one thing you can do is you can at least avoid having your toes stepped on some of the time. That's this co-creation, this being a participant in your own life. And if you choose to mindfully dance with life, you don't bump into others, you don't step on other people's toes nearly as much. And you also have this sense of participating in your life. And the anxiety, this existential angst, creates this anxiety that is makes us very uncomfortable in our own skin sometimes. When you're saying, oh no, this is life, and it's going to dance with me, so I'm going to dance with it. In my experience, a lot of that anxiety goes away. Not all at once, but through the years. And so that you have this sense of this that third kind of suffering that the Buddha talked about, again, which I'm not going to describe in detail tonight, but this samkara suffering that's there, this kind of lack of there being any place to rest, any place to stand. It turns out that the emptiness is a great ground. That emptiness itself is a kind of ground that we can know in all of our imperfections. Starting here, starting with this first noble truth of knowing suffering, that's something we can all do, right? We're all equipped. We get all these opportunities to practice, and we don't have to be other than we are. You're just fine as you are to know suffering. And so it becomes this chance. And as we learn to do this, we do learn to dance with life. So I thank you for your attention in this, and I would like to open it up for a few minutes of questions or comments or anything you would like. So thank you very much. So any questions or comments from your life, from your practice, from the guided meditation, anything that you would like to ask? Not everybody at once. How can I choose?
I think that what do you think about the fact that sometimes we feel like we've contributed to the causes and conditions when we suffer. So it's not completely, it might not feel completely free.
Well, many times we have contributed. Both in terms of suffering of ourselves or others, or how we're suffering now, adding suffering to suffering. The Buddha's teaching is to start right now. So if from the ego's point of view, we want to make that contribution me and mine, does it ever do any good to make it me and mine? I have not observed it so. But being present in this moment and taking responsibility for owning to what damage we may have caused to another or what damage we have caused to ourselves and not repeating it, learning from it, or taking care of, say, we've damaged our bodies because we've abused drugs. So we can go around hating ourselves because we've abused drugs, or we can take care of our body right now out of compassion. Likewise, we may have ended the relationship that we wish we still had, and we don't have that relationship. So we can make this a story that's me and mine. This is my story of my lost love, or we can manifest love in whatever circumstances we're in now. May not have been the form of our preference, but it's what's available to us now. That all starts with this willingness to acknowledge, to know the ouch of this. But it's not a lot. Sometimes people get hung up into this thing about future births and all of this. But I find no reason that we have to get caught in that kind of intellectual debate. Because each moment is a moment of being reborn. And each moment is the moment that fructifies in our lives or another, as T.S. Eliot says. This moment, this nowness. And so that kind of orientation really starts to change. And we can watch the story start. We start these narratives over and over again. And we can let the narrative run without believing in it. There's nothing wrong with that narrative. Oh, this happened and this happened and I did this and I could have done that. And if this person had done this or if I'd only known about this and so on, that's okay. Sometimes we learn something from that. That's part of how we learn, because we do learn a lot from story. But other times, it's just a way of sort of running the soap opera. It's sort of like inner flicks, you're seeing the home movie in your head. And that's okay, but we don't have to buy into it. Yes. I didn't have, for myself, I didn't have the teacher. I didn't have a teacher that I needed. And the blueprint of practice, of finding freedom, it, for me, was so strong in Vipassana. I still do both. I'm still involved in both practices and I'm very respectful of both traditions. Have a teacher in India that's Swami, at least that's his origins, and he, by the way, all those years later, gave me a mantra. And the kicker is, it was a Buddhist mantra. So both finding many people in the Buddhist tradition are mixed, of more than one tradition. And I don't find that a problem, except at certain junctures where you have to kind of commit certain things one way or the other. But for the most part, I don't find that a problem. In part because the Buddhism is not a belief system.
You ever think back about the days of publishing and why spiritual practice could not be compatible with
I wasn't mature enough. If I'd had more maturity, I was 32 or 3 when I took over Esquire, and I didn't feel like a pup to me, but looking back, I can see that I was just a pup. And I could take that job now, I believe, and do that job and maintain my practice. I was good about doing the job from the spiritual point of view. I was very aware of not causing harm and had my compromises, which I suffered over and which I have to own to this day, where I felt as though I did make certain compromises and all at times. But what happened is I couldn't renew myself in it. I just didn't have the strength. I didn't have enough momentum of practice. Well, Susie, I'm sorry, in the back.
Kind of a related question. How do you know when to change or leave a situation and when to suffer through it in a way that is suffering?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. That's such a good question, and I do a whole day long about the Dharma in the workplace, because there's so many questions like that that come up when you say no and don't go along with something, and which puts you in real risk in your job, and you need that job. Lots of things come up like that, and we can look at those in real detail. And this question of when to stay in the job and when to go on, what I ordinarily, I'd have to hear your particular situation to give you, I would tailor my suggestions to your situation. But in a general way, I say first treat the job and its difficulty as practice, so that you're not leaving because of aversion. Because there's no, you'll just go find some other place to fill aversion, if that's what's the motivation. But then when you've worked with that a bit, you then start to open at the heart and belly level and ask, what is the felt sense of this? And when we can do that, the sense of, no, this is not right, now becomes more clear. And it doesn't mean that you're not scared or that you don't have second thoughts and all this, but there's a felt sense, and what I suggest is trust that felt sense. And then I do not believe in acting impulsively where you walk and say, I quit. You proceed with mindfulness and compassion towards yourself in terms of how you can leave that job and take care of your survival and your family's survival needs. So it's not a question of getting up on one's high horse when one's got this felt sense at all. It gives one the confidence and the patience to move through it well. And then the other thing I say, and it's certainly what I did for myself, is that to not cause harm by leaving the job where you've left your responsibilities unfulfilled. So I was very conscious of that in my own decision making, and it took me some years to do that, because I had taken a lot of people's money and they believed in me, and I was not going to leave them high and dry. That was just my value system in that situation. You don't have to take what someone else thinks is your responsibility, but what you, upon reflection in this dharmic way, feels like your responsibility. So otherwise you've gone back into the duality of you're pleasing them, there's a you who's pleasing those other people. That's not the Dharma. But what feels like, yes, this is mine to do, and then you do it. That's true in a relationship and taking care of friends and parents and so forth. That speak to your question? Last question, the back over here. Well, as I mentioned in the guided meditation, which I did because I wanted you just to be exposed to my view, the Buddha's first foundation of mindfulness is awareness of the body and the body. So the breath, awareness of the breath is one of the body practices. It's not separate from, and there's lots of different ways you can relate to the breath. So for you to have as your default practice, awareness of the body is, in my view, a skillful means. On the other hand, you don't want to be afraid of your thoughts. So when you have your thoughts, you can, if you go to judgment, notice how judgment feels in the body. And the default mantra here is to say, is this suffering or not suffering? Not that you're going to fix it if it's suffering, but you're just going to notice, is this suffering or not suffering? If you notice long enough, you start to move, at least this again is my experience, you start to move away from suffering if you're able to stay present to knowing suffering. Because as the Buddha said, we all want to be happy. This is what we share. We all want to be happy. All beings want to be happy, he said. And so when you stay present with it, it's like if I picked up this bell and it was hot, I would put it down because it was hot. Not because I go, oh, I'm a bad person, I'm burning myself, or oh, I'm dumb because I'm burning myself. It's the ouch that causes us to put it down. That works on all levels in our nervous system. It just takes longer when it's about our judgments about ourselves. The last thing to say about that, which I learned from Ajahn Sumedho also, it's a great bell. It might have gotten hot because it was sitting next to the heater or something. I don't want to throw the bell away just because I picked it up and it burned me. It's the putting down that's the freedom. You're having desires, you're having hopes. You're not burned because you have preferences. You're burned when you hold on to them, to the attachment. More later. Thank you again.